Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, where we catch you up on the political news of last week and preview our week ahead. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Joining me this morning at the roundtable is Andrew Tobias, a State House reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Andrew.
Good morning.
Aaron Glynn, state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Hello, Aaron.
Hi, happy to be here.
And last but certainly not least is Daryl Rowland, politics and investigative reporter for ABC. Good morning.
Great to be here, Anna.
The big news over the weekend came from a federal judge. Judge Michael Watson ruled that Ohio's law banning foreign nationals and green card holders from donating to campaigns violates their free speech rights. Let's unpack this for a moment, Daryl. The judge isn't saying Ohio can't block foreigners from donating to campaigns, right?
Right. And again, candidate campaigns, those are already banned. So what we were talking about now is these statewide issue campaigns, which Republicans have not liked because Ohio voters have passed issues that they don't like. So they want to ban, foreign participation. And that's all the farther the bill went until it got to the Senate when, it was in the House. Representative Brian Stewart said, how about green card holders? Let's ban them too. And the main sponsor of this legislation, Bill Seitz from Cincinnati, said, you're going to lose this one because courts have upheld that. Senator Nirajantani made the same point in the Senate, and he was the lone Republican vote against the legislation. Guess what? They were right. The majority of Republicans were wrong. So green card holders, the Judge Watson, who's Republican, appointed by George W. Bush, who should add, says, hey, these folks, we send them to war. They're eligible to be soldiers and fight for the country. I think we can let them vote. And that's been the reasoning for years and years.
Aaron, this whole hullabaloo with this law about banning foreigners from donating to campaigns here, this has a lot to do with the redistricting amendment we're going to vote on in November, right?
Yeah, that's the issue everybody's talking about in the November election. Republicans are concerned, including Mike DeWine, that the redistricting amendment, Republicans have a supermajority in the Ohio legislature now, and they're worried about losing hold on that. And so I think their laser focus, as Daryl mentioned, on ballot campaigns, which have not gone well for them in recent years.
Yeah, and Andrew, this is kind of tied to this Swiss billionaire who donates to something called the 1630 Fund, which donated to Citizens Not Politicians, and potentially some of Weiss's money funneled through here to Ohio.
Yeah, that was, it's kind of, the way that the law was written was that it described you couldn't, if you were a non-U.S. citizen, you couldn't indirectly fund a ballot issue, and so arguably Hansberg
Vice? I think so.
Yes,
great,
I'm a writer.
Jerry, yes.
I don't speak about these things. But he funded, he gave money to a foundation which in the past has given money to the 1630 Fund, which subsequently gave money to these ballot issues that Republicans don't like. And so they raised these concerns that, including the redistricting amendment now, the abortion rights amendment that passed in November, that that was the impetus behind this whole thing. And so we saw actually the redistricting campaign, which is called Citizens Not Politicians, ahead of the a campaign finance deadline in July, actually spent down to the dollar pretty much every single donation that they received. You know, part of the timing of this ruling was that the law, which passed in early July, I believe, or maybe late June, was set to take effect on Monday, yesterday, and the ruling came out on Friday or Saturday. So it hasn't really done anything yet, but clearly you see signs of these ballot issue organizations taking action to try to just deal with it being taken into effect.
Now, Republicans essentially have two choices. They can come back and try to pass something just for foreigners, which would probably stand up to constitutional question, or they can continue to fight this in the court, or maybe do both.
Well, right. I know some of the initial reaction of Republicans were saying, hey, why did you throw out the whole law when it was just the green card part that you really had an issue with? So I could see that easily being the subject of an appeal. Time is short, of course. Here we are again. It's Ohio. It's after Labor Day. Let the lawsuits begin. And they've begun many months ago, of course. I don't know if they would come back for a, I mean, they're not scheduled to be back after until after the election.
Yeah.
I don't know if they'd come back and pass a new law just without the green card holder part.
They need an emergency clause, too, which is tight in there. Well, they could probably get it.
They didn't get it before when they could have. So it had to do, more, I think, more with just getting butts in seats in the legislature as opposed to political support. But then again, you never really know until you actually cast the vote.
While we're on the topic of citizenship, Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose wants lawmakers to give him the authority to ask for proof of citizenship when we all register to vote. LaRose says he found 597 non-citizens on our voter rolls, and I do want to be clear, that is 0.007% of registered voters in Ohio.
I knew you would do the math, so I didn't do it. I knew you would do it.
But Andrew, these voter registrations of non-citizens seem to be coming from confusion at the BMV.
That's always been kind of, when this has come up in the past, which it has, that's generally what you'll hear from elections officials. I don't have the number offhand, but Secretary LaRose has referred several hundreds of these in years past, and they very rarely, I'm actually not aware of a single prosecution that pertains to specifically the citizenship issue, but under federal law, when somebody goes to the BMV, which you can be a non-U.S. citizen and get a driver's license, you're required to show the person who's registering a voter registration form and give them the opportunity to sign it. You know, not a lawyer, so maybe you're not supposed to if it's a non-citizen. But regardless, often what happens is what people say is that there's language barriers. People sign the form. You know, they check a box they don't really intend to. You know, if you put yourself in the shoes of a non-citizen, you know, it says on the form that voter fraud is a felony. Like, if you commit a felony, you very well could be deported. So it's one of those things that, like I said, rarely actually results in prosecution, but it's something that happens. And, you know, now that, you know, LaRose has been reviewing this, now he suddenly thinks that it requires action. So.
Yeah. Joe Moss, a Columbus attorney who's handled some of these cases, told the State House News Bureau that the language barrier is often the contributing factor. And these people aren't trying to get away with something. The form was put in front of them at the BMV and they signed it.
And we should point out that of those 597 on the rolls, only 138 actually voted. So it's an even, I don't know if you've done the math on that, but, and even just add another 0.0 to that fraction. Now, again, this is not to say that we all want voter rolls as clean as possible, and I don't think anyone's going to argue against that, doing it legitimately. But do you come to a point where you're pursuing this to the exclusion of other things? You know, this is the white whale search in some extent. Now, if there is a white whale out there, let's go get him. But okay, they're pretty rare.
National Republicans are recruiting Ohioans to protect our vote by becoming poll watchers this November. Aaron, Ohio kind of sticks out on the list of states that the RNC plans to monitor in this way because we're not a swing state and our election wasn't contested in 2020. So why are we on this list for poll watchers?
Yeah, that's kind of confusing, especially since Attorney General Dave Yost said that Ohio is the gold standard as far as election integrity. But we're still on this battleground list of about 18 states, and they want at least 5,000 poll watchers to be selected by the County Board of Elections and just kind of keep an eye on how voting happens at these precincts. So we'll see what that looks like in practice.
And this is different from poll workers because county boards of elections, I will say, are still looking for poll workers. So if you have election day off, if you're retired, you can go get paid. You can actually be in the building checking people in. But Daryl, there are rules here about how close poll watchers can get, how they can engage with voters to avoid intimidation.
That's right. And I know Michael Watley, the RNC chairman, who actually was in Ohio to help kick off this effort, insisted that was not going to happen. They know the rules and all that. The other side may have some skepticism of that. They asked the logical question, I think, that Aaron implied, if Ohio, and you implied, that if Ohio's a gold standard, why are we looking for something that has not really been there and would not make a difference in the election, even if it were? It is an oddity. I was really surprised to see Ohio on that list.
Maybe it's because we have such a big U.S. Senate race. That's the only logical thing I could think of.
Yeah, there's a few competitive congressional races, too.
Oh, that's true.
Maybe
Marcy Kaptur.
Sometimes you think about these things in terms of maybe there's people in Ohio who give money to Republicans that care about this. So that's sort of like an aspect of it that you have to sort of consider as well. But I imagine the U.S. Senate election is a, you know, that's a reasonable explanation.
I actually want to play a clip of Republican National Committee Chair Michael Whatley from when he was here, and he is responding to concerns about voter intimidation.
No, I think one of the things that we focus on in the training sessions is making sure that we respect the process, we respect the poll workers, and we respect, most importantly, the voters.
So he says that won't happen, but I will say if someone, anybody, not anybody, is harassing you outside of a polling location, you should call your county board of elections. They will want to know about it, and they will be the people to handle it. You can also tell the poll workers inside the office if you are in any way intimidated or harassed outside. There are strict rules about campaigning outside of polling locations.
And right, inside the flags.
Yeah.
The flags
They'll be clearly marked.
Yes, they'll be clearly marked. I mean, if you're caught in a parking lot, you're kind of fair game to a certain extent. I think there's a couple other things. You know, Michael Whatley is a, I guess we're calling them election deniers. He has called the 2020 results fraudulent. Former President Trump, of course, has increased the rhetoric, basically saying, hey, I've got the votes, so the only way we lose is if Democrats cheat. So we are already setting the stage in what could be a microscopically close election nationally for lots and lots of second guessing.
Absentee ballot application forms are also going out to all registered voters. Andrew, why do they send them to everyone?
So this, I mean, the story kind of like, let's take a step back in time to days of yore in 2010, I think. I just know this from covering Cleveland. The Cuyahoga County executive at the time, who's a Democrat, who ended up running for governor, Ed Fitzgerald, maybe other counties too, but definitely Cuyahoga County, made plans to perform a universal unsolicited absentee ballot mailing in Cuyahoga County. And subsequently, I guess 2011 or so, before, you know, they're going to do it ahead of the 2012 election. And Fitzgerald made a deal with then Secretary of State John Husted, who's a Republican, who's lieutenant governor now, that rather than have one county doing this and, you know, having a lack of uniformity across the state, they struck a deal where the state then said, okay, we are going to do this in every county. There's some back and forth about what elections to do it for, but we ultimately settled in state law to do it in even year elections, which mean either running for the governor's race as the top of the ballot or the presidential race. And so that's something that Ohio has done every 2 years since 2012. They send not a ballot, but a form to request a ballot to every registered voter in the state. It's something like 800,000 or 8 million people. Sorry. And I haven't gotten mine yet. So
I have not gotten mine yet.
I've spoken to people who have, including in the Columbus area. So I'm not sure I'm going to vote absentee, but I would like my form.
I would like it too. And if you don't get one, that is probably a good reminder to check your voter registration, make sure your address is updated. The last day that you have to register to vote is October 7th.
Yeah, and I don't have all the details filled on this, but it's not uncommon in years past for the Secretary of State's office to perform multiple mailings. They sort of use this to confirm whether or not people live where they're at. I know that's something they've said is going to be a greater emphasis this year, so I don't know if it's going to be a triage to try to make sure that voter rolls are up to date. But if you're wondering about this, you can always just get your own form. Your county board of elections will give you one. You can even just print it off and mail it in. But yeah, this is, if you got one, look for the Secretary of State watermark. It's a real thing. It's legit.
And while we're on the topic of voting, Secretary of State Frank LaRose wants to make some changes to our drop boxes. So a federal court just a little while ago ruled that an Ohio law violated the rights of people with disabilities. Now, this deals with who can drop off a ballot at the drop box. So you don't have to, you can mail in your ballot, you can bring it to your county board of elections, or you can just drive by the drop box and put it in. And so advocates sued over this restriction on who can bring them in. So if you are disabled, if you cannot get to the polls for some reason, someone can deliver your ballot. So now that we have a more expansive list of who can drop them off, LaRose is saying maybe we should eliminate drop boxes, or maybe we should have a limit that you can only drop off one ballot at a time.
Yeah, I actually was wondering about this last week because, like you said, the court ruling had to do with disabled people, and the plaintiff in that case, I can't remember the details of their condition, but they described how they had a mailbox at their apartment complex. They needed help getting mail to it. It was a burden, and the judge, you know, agreed with that. The question I had is who is disabled? Do you have to have some kind of, you know, you have to collect disability from the federal government? You know, I had questions about the criteria. It's clear that Secretary LeVeroz does as well. So I guess we'll kind of see how this sinks in a little bit. But LeVeroz has been a proponent of drop boxes in the past. Ahead of the 2020 election, there was a fight over whether to allow multiple drop boxes in large counties like Franklin County or Cuyahoga County, where it makes sense maybe if you live in a rural county with one city in it, that's where the ballot would be. But if you're in a large area, it can be hard to get across town, especially if you don't have you know, access to transportation and stuff like that. So it's a real turn. And I think, like, all of these different topics we're talking about in conjunction, there's a common thread of LeRose kind of adopting arguments or rhetoric or whatnot that are on the side of restricting voting. Although certainly I think there are questions about how this particular court ruling was going to be implemented and kind of what the implications are of it downstream from just the issue on its face of this particular disabled person and the kind of challenges that they face.
Yeah, and this is a court ruling that the state lost. This law was successfully challenged, and it would be an ironic twist out of a judge saying, no, you have to be more expansive, certainly in the specific cases of disabled voters, opening up the drop box process. Now we're talking about making it even more narrow, perhaps even eliminating it. So it's amazing. Anyway, there's all this dancing with some very fundamental election procedures, and we're, what, 2 months out now? And actually, you know,
it might be too late to do any of this, really.
Well, exactly. Does he have the chance? Well, and he has done some of this by a rule over the week. I mean, that's kind of what started your conversation. He is allowed to issue rules. You know, he's the boss of the County Board of Elections. He's the chief elections official in Ohio. So he can send out directives and say, you do it this way. But furthermore, you know, he says, do it this way. But should we just eliminate them all together? So there's more to be written in this as the days grow shorter toward the election.
But I wanted to say, like, kind of the broader concern here is that the term is ballot harvesting, which I always think kind of sounds sinister. I don't. Do you guys agree with that? Maybe it's like thinks of our farmers and how hard they work or something. I don't know. Maybe it's actually great.
Don't you go to the ballot harvesting festival every year? get some spicy cider and stuff.
Exactly. But, you know, so let's say that there's a nursing home and there are a bunch of voters there, and you have community organizations or that might go around and get all of the ballots from these people and deliver them all together. And the kind of concern is that there's like basically a chain of custody issue. What if the election, what if that particular person just throws them all in the trash? What if they cast some and not others? I mean, it kind of raises questions about the security of that individual ballot. And in some states, including Ohio, that what I just described is illegal. But then it just kind of gets tricky when you're talking about these individual circumstances of people who actually need help. And there is a push and pull in this, and there's sort of a broader context for it. But you have some states like California where this is permitted, and you see Republicans basically saying that we have to be good at ballot harvesting, you know, to compete. So it's just kind of, there's a continuum of these kinds of things.
Yeah, everybody does it differently. As somebody who used to live in Denver, Colorado, I will note that the city of Denver has more drop boxes than the state of Ohio put together. So I think there's close to 200 drop boxes in the city of Denver. So everybody does it differently. Coming up, we're going to talk about Ohio lawmakers who are looking to clarify the rules for college athletes who earn money from endorsement deals. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Andrew Tobias from Cleveland.com, Aaron Glynn from the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Daryl Roland from ABC6. The Buckeyes crushed Akron in their season opener on Saturday. Go Bucks. But a few days before the game, a pair of Republican lawmakers introduced legislation to update how those football players earn money off their name, image, and likeness. Aaron, what are Jay Edwards and Adam Matthews proposing here?
Yeah, they say they want to stay competitive with other schools like in the Southeastern Conference by making it more easy for athletes to work directly with these name, image, and likeness collectives that are associated with the universities. So the law has a lot of clarifying language. It says that student athletes can have a lawyer or an agent look over these contracts before they sign them, and that universities are not liable for anything that the terms of the contract between these students and the collectives.
Do we think this might help with recruitment? That's one of the arguments being made, right? That these nonprofits that are largely proliferated through the SEC raise a ton of money for the players. And, you know, now it looks like the players want to go where they can earn the most money.
Well, about 10 minutes into the news conference, Anna, that question actually was asked. Representative, from Cincinnati said, we think it will. It's really quite expansive. And, of course, this is a pun, I guess, intended, playing field that is just rapidly shifting. And, you know, us old-timers who remember, well, gee, even Tattoo Gate some 15 years ago.
Oh, my goodness. That seems like peanuts now.
Exactly. Well, it is, yeah. And the representatives are quick to say that we don't necessarily like the system, but we are given this system, so let's regulate it. This would allow the universities and these foundations to work directly together. Now they are, at least in name, separated, although there's a whole lot of back and forth, a lot of cooperation there. And it also pays away. Again, there's litigation in this field. There's revenue sharing litigation that is out there. If the players win that, you know, this legislation would pave the way for Ohio State to pay players directly. And again, some of you old timers like me are out there just like just shaking your head at this. It's like, did we wake up in another universe or what?
It's a brave new world. Ohio State President Ted Carter sat down with all sides last week, and I asked him about these proposed changes. Here's what he had to say.
So the name, image, likeness landscape has been really pretty crazy looking backwards. You know, most states like Ohio have put some legislation in place to help student athletes obtain the ability to negotiate with third parties. I'm just very appreciative of our lawmakers looking out for our student athletes. I know they're trying to do some good things, make us competitive in the market with other states, particularly, you know, states that are in the Southeastern Conference. We have had some initial conversation, but we haven't officially engaged with the language that's in this proposed law.
And it's very new.
Yeah, and I look forward to it. I have been following it very closely. And again, I'm just thankful that our lawmakers are looking out for our student athletes.
I will say this isn't chump change. The Buckeyes are also making headlines in the last week for being a $20 million team, which means the football players collectively are earning $20 million in endorsement deals and brand agreements.
It's helpful to think of the Ohio State Buckeyes football team is basically just being a semi-professional football team because...
And it's always kind of been that way, yeah. Just in terms of like time and practice and tickets.
Yeah, I think that if you think about it, there's definitely a logical argument to say that why shouldn't, if the school's making money off of them, why shouldn't they be able to sponsor a local car dealership or something? But what if the car dealership is, you know, giving somebody $2 million? And what if a bunch of boosters got together and gave the car dealership $2 million to have that? So we're basically talking about like a salary pool. And so I guess that's kind of like the ultimate conclusion of all this stuff. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, eventually if it just says Ohio State University on the checks and pay the players, you know, that's sort of the implication of this.
Yeah. The Buckeyes also had a touching moment of silence for Columbus Blue Jackets star Johnny Gaudreau and his brother before the game started. The two men died Thursday when they were struck by a car, which was the whole story was just so incredibly sad.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot to offer than that, but it was shocking. I mean, he was, their best player, and it's just obviously sad anytime that somebody loses their life.
Well, and he was a star that actually wanted to play in Columbus for the Blue Jackets. So it's like, it's kind of like, you know, again, us old timers, you remember when Bernie Kosar, he actually wanted to play for the Browns. It's like, wow. And he's, you know, loved forever. But, you know, Johnny Hockey, the tributes that have been down here at the Nationwide Arena, mm-hmm. I don't know if anyone saw the ones from Calgary. There's like aerial shots they had to get for all the stuff that was put out. I don't know if it was outside the arena or exactly where in Calgary, but it was a pile of stuff. Calgary is his former team, of course.
Well, let's talk about the U.S. Senate race. Bernie Moreno is trying to relaunch his family's car business. Andrew, you reported that he has spent nearly $10 million on a plot of land off 71 in Delaware County.
Yeah, this is a really good example of the kind of story that you can write based off of the disclosures that Senate candidates have to do. I don't know exactly what the rules are, but I know that they file these forms every year, and in them include businesses that they own, and the name, you know, the names of the businesses, as well as income sources and investments and things like that. And you could basically connect the dots and see that Moreno is doing this. So I'll say that, having followed him for a while, that he's been kind of so. Bernie made his money in car dealerships. That's kind of why he's where he is today. And at some point in the mid-2010s, he kind of decided to walk away from the business. He kind of felt like they were getting outdated and pretty rapidly closed everything down. But then subsequently, he's kind of publicly mused about getting back into it because one of his sons, who's in his 20s, was interested in doing it. And so I'll say that this didn't come out of nowhere, but That's kind of the plan. And so we don't what his campaign said about this is that because I guess Bernie has said that he has walked away from other business interests that he has because he didn't want to create conflicts of interest. And so I guess, you know, maybe this would pose a conflict of interest sometime if let's say the U.S. Senate were to consider car dealership regulations or something like that. What his campaign said was that this is not Bernie's involvement personally, that he's creating this for his son. It is clearly money coming from Bernie Moreno's, you know, funds and stuff like that. But that they're basically distancing himself from actually running this eventual business. And they also said that they're not even going to break ground until November. But I did see Sherrod Brown's campaign release a hastily produced video showing what I assume is a low paid staffer, although maybe it's a campaign. I don't know. Maybe not. Overworked, I'm sure. And blowing up one of those giant inflatable, like 20-foot guys who wave around in the air. And so they're kind of having fun with, again, just kind of teasing Bernie Moreno as being like this cheesy car dealer, sort of, you know, denigrating him in that way. But yeah, they're certainly making hay out of it.
Yeah. He took out a mortgage, though, for Mercedes-Benz. So it will be a Mercedes-Benz dealership in all likelihood in Delaware County for his son.
Yeah, by the outlet mall is basically my understanding.
Daryl, this is not the first car dealer to run for office. Jim Renacci, famously. U.S. Congressman, candidate for governor here in the state of Ohio, Senate candidate in the state of Ohio, also ran car dealerships.
Yeah, and Del Spitzer, but way back in the day, was involved politically as well. It is a little intriguing. First of all, let's restate the underlying fact of this race, which probably gets said every time we talk about it, is Sherrod Brown needs Donald Trump voters. Donald Trump is almost certain to carry Ohio, name your percentage. So for them to a certain percentage of Donald Trump voters then have to turn around and vote for Sherrod Brown if Sherrod Brown is to get reelected. He knows this. So he's not exactly campaigning on a national basis or anything. He's not really campaigning about, look at all the, from his perspective, stupid stuff Donald Trump is saying that Bernie Moreno is merely just nodding assent to. No, it's more the personal character and business practices. You know, trying to get Bernie Moreno is kind of an out of touch, you know, big wig corporate executive who doesn't really care about you. He's had all these questionable dealings, litigation with his workers and all that. And it's intriguing to me that that has been the emphasis of the Brown campaign rather than any big national issues or anything like that.
Brown is one of two incumbent Democratic senators from a state where Trump has won twice. And if he pulls it off, if Brown wins in November, he will be only the second U.S. senator to ever do so in modern history. The other was Susan Collins of Maine in 2020. So it's not impossible, Andrew, but it's not going to be easy.
So, I mean, make what you will of the polls, given that they've kind of been wacky here in Ohio, really hit and miss, especially in presidential years. But roughly speaking, they show Trump winning by 9 or 10, slightly better than the 8 points that he won Ohio by in 16 or 20. So Sherrod Brown's going to have to find 10% of Republican voters to also vote for him. And that's
a tough lift.
That is very difficult to do, especially in how polarized our society has become today. So the way that I envision this is that if he pulls this off, it will be very close. And so hence, you know, maybe it's the giant inflatable video that kind of tipped the scales on it. But just any number of minor issues, I guess, like could be translate to the votes that he needs to win, because I think it's going to be close.
And speaking of politics, the former head of the Ohio Democratic Party, Chris Redfern, says the political bug has bit him again and he's considering getting back into politics. Daryl, what makes Redfern want to go back?
I was wondering the same. I don't know if he's just bored or whatever, because he's got his little establishment up there on the Marblehead Peninsula, a little winery and everything. And
the Redfern Inn. I've been there.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Have you stayed there?
I've never stayed there, but I bought a mug and gave it to a friend as a gift, and I think I had a glass of wine, too, while I was there.
Ah, conflict of interest, that, huh?
Yeah.
But, yeah, Chris Redfern.
No, he paid for the glass of wine.
Yeah. He was an intriguing character. He was intriguing when he was Democratic state chairman. And, of course, as usual, Democrats didn't do all that well, which is, you know, rinse and repeat for the past two or three decades here in Ohio. He is, these days, and now that redistricting has come to the fore in our political discussion, he's gotten a little bit of notoriety, if, I don't know if it's the right word. But they basically had a deal right before the 2010 elections, he and John Husted, to come up with a bipartisan solution to this redistricting mess. And who knows if it had worked any better than the one that's eventually enacted years later. But at least it was. But we see this so much from both sides of political parties. It got closer and closer to 2010, and Redfern made the calculation, hey, Ted Strickland's going to win re-election. We're actually going to be in control of the pen. Why would I give up a compromise and make this bipartisan thing?
Did not work out the way he'd hoped.
Yeah. There's some John Casey guy that messed up those plans, and others some down-ticket races. So I don't know. I don't know what his district is like or anything, but he certainly has a name that's known, better for better or worse.
So I will say the way I view this is that the fact that we're talking about Chris Redfern running isn't a great sign for Democrats, because Chris, while he did an able job running the party during the Obama years, lost his state house district that he held around 2014, the same year that was a big Republican wipeout, and he kind of took the blame for that. And so it doesn't really mean anything about him personally, but it's really that it's looking to the past for these names of when the state Democratic Party here was more relevant. And I think were there to be a more established front-running candidate, you wouldn't have people like Chris Redfern kind of coming out of the woodwork. Now, I will say that I don't know that he's never run for statewide office before. I don't know that he's specifically narrowly looking at the governor's office. Maybe he's just floating his name. He did say that to my colleague Jeremy Pelzer that he might be interested in a down ballot race. So the Democrats could do worse than somebody like Chris Redfern. But it is kind of striking to me that, you know, like the meme from Star Wars about there's a name I haven't heard for a long time or whatever Alec Guinness said in Star Wars. It's a name from years past, and Democrats are really searching, you know, for a way out of the kind of political challenges they've been having recently, especially with candidates.
Sales of recreational marijuana have been going on for the last couple of weeks, and the Ohio Division of Cannabis Control has fined 5 businesses a total of $212,000 for infractions, including one that used an ice cream truck to advertise recreational sales. So these violations are kind of all over the map. It's, you know, from using the ice cream truck to, I guess it's par for the course, right?
Yeah, I think the other fine that I remember was for language on their website that said, "Can you take me higher?" these businesses have to run all of their marketing and advertising strategies through the state division.
Yeah, and prices are finally starting to come down. The cost of cannabis spiked when recreational sales started, but they have started to drop. Do we expect them to keep dropping a little bit?
That's what the retailers are saying, that as demand kind of dies down a little bit, the prices will drop.
Yeah, the third week of sales, dispensaries rang in $10 million, which was lower than previous weeks. So it seems that initial, oh my gosh, it's legal, is kind of ramping down into whatever normal will be for cannabis sales. And we're going to take a quick break. Coming up, Ohio's 24-hour waiting period for abortions comes to an end, for now. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Andrew Tobias, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, Aaron Glynn, State Government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Daryl Rowland, politics and investigative reporter for ABC6. Ohio abortion clinics have started same-day abortions after a judge ruled that mandating women wait 24 hours is unconstitutional. Andrew, this is a temporary order. So what happens next in the legal process?
Yeah, we've talked before on this show about a really good example is the heartbeat bill case in Cincinnati, which predates the abortion rights amendment that voters approved in November. But what happened there was shortly after Roe v. Wade got struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court, abortion clinics filed in Cincinnati a lawsuit challenging the heartbeat bill, which went into effect, which banned abortion as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy. The judge there issued what's called a preliminary injunction, which is meant to be a temporary order that a judge issues. They find that the lawsuit exceeds a certain threshold by which the argument basically is that the law would create a permanent harm, and so the judge needs to step in and issue a preliminary injunction to prevent that from happening while the case plays out. And we saw that the preliminary injunction is still in place, 2 years later. And the distinction is that you can't appeal a preliminary injunction because it's a preliminary ruling. It's not a final ruling. So just with that kind of like law lesson out of the way, in this case, the a group of abortion clinics and abortion rights advocates sued over the state's 24-hour waiting period. The judge in Franklin County issued a preliminary injunction. And that happened about, I think, 2 weeks ago, a week ago Friday or whenever it was. The next day, there was an abortion provider in the Cleveland area that began issuing same-day abortions. And so, I spoke with clinic officials, including at Planned Parenthood, who basically said they viewed it as an urgent issue, that the ruling was in place. And I think that they're prepared for the possibility that it may be overturned at some point down the chain. But this was the first time where you saw an abortion restriction of many that are on the books in Ohio directly get challenged and then ruled, and then there'd be a judge who issues an actual substantive ruling about it, citing the abortion rights amendment that voters approved in November. So this is interesting for a lot of reasons, but, kind of like the voting issues we were talking about before, when you have a judge getting involved with laws, there's still just a process that has to play out legally, and we're sort of probably in the earliest stages of that when it comes to this one.
Aaron, the judge cited Attorney General Dave Yost's own legal analysis in ruling against him on this, writing, quote, that prior to the amendment passing, which means the Reproductive Rights Amendment, Attorney Yost agreed with the plaintiff's argument as to the legal applicable standard. So,
yeah, he really changed his mind, first saying that, like, the voters approved this amendment and that, but now they are trying to keep all of these restrictions on the books, although the amendment does say that the state cannot interfere directly or indirectly with a person's right to get an abortion or make their own reproductive decisions. So though the amendment seems clear-cut, the state is really trying to keep all this stuff on the books.
ultimately, it's going to the Ohio Supreme Court. So we'll wait and see.
Yeah. But what the clinic said about this was that when you have somebody who's trying to get an abortion, the way the law worked was that you have to go to two separate medical appointments.
On two different days.
At least 24 hours apart. And so they described to me patients who would have to jump through all these hoops just to take off work or whatnot for one appointment, much less the second one. And so Preterm Cleveland, which is one of the providers I spoke with, said that the 24-hour waiting period on average spanned 10 days between, you know, the logistical challenges of, you know, that people face kind of trying to actually get there, as well as anybody who's ever scheduled any kind of medical appointment. You can't just pick the date and time that you want. There's, you know, there's a line. So they said that the law was a burden, that it, you know, posed financial challenges, much less, you know, I imagine that there are scenarios, although this isn't the most common scenario, that Ohio has less restrictive abortion laws now than places like Kentucky and Indiana. So if you have somebody who's coming from out of town, they would have to, you know, arrange for lodging and all that stuff. So it's a very, like I said before, they saw the urgency because of the burden that they view this as creating for their patients. And that's the way that it plays out in reality.
And what Andrew said there at the end about coming from other states, I mean, I talked to Planned Parenthood, basically, because they do mainly the facilities for people who do the border crossing of southern Ohio from these other states. And I was surprised to hear they've gotten women from 24 states, Florida, Texas, folks like that who have more strict bans. Now, who would have thought Ohio would be in this position?
Did not see that one coming.
Of having less restrictive abortion rules. But yeah, we are, as Andrew says, we basically are in a time now. I mean, we've seen for the last at least quarter century, year after year after year, it was, here's this abortion restriction, here's this abortion restriction. All the time while Roe versus Wade was the law of the land, so abortion was legal, but how can we chip away at it by these various requirements? The waiting period, you got to have an ultrasound, you got to read this literature, you got to have a licensed physician instead of another medical provider. We could be facing the next several years of trench warfare in the courts as one by one we go through these. Well, does the new law, the new constitutional amendment, does that wipe these out or not? And again, three stages of court, so
it's going to be a while.
I think so.
It's like a messy divorce. In the end, only the lawyers win. So Vice President Kamala Harris had her first sit-down interview since becoming the Democratic presidential nominee. It covered a lot of ground, but I want to talk about her position on fracking. Here's part of the exchange between Harris and CNN anchor Dana Bash.
When you were in Congress, you supported the Green New Deal. And in 2019, you said, quote, there is no question I'm in favor of banning fracking. Fracking, as you know, is a pretty big issue, particularly in your must-win state of Pennsylvania.
Sure.
Do you still want to ban fracking?
No, and I made that clear on the debate stage in 2020, that I would not ban fracking. As vice president, I did not ban fracking. As president, I will not ban fracking.
So, Andrew, is this a reverse? This is a reversal of her position when she ran for president in 2019. What has changed other than perhaps the need to win Pennsylvania?
I mean, I would say the need to win Pennsylvania is foremost in my mind. But I guess, you know, when Kamala Harris was running for president in 2019, she was trying to appeal to Democratic primary voters in New Hampshire. You know, generally speaking, in primaries, you see the candidates stake out positions that are like the purest form of their base voters. And so she ran to the left. And now that she's been parachuted into the middle of a hyper competitive presidential race, she's running to the center. But, you know, fracking in a state like Ohio, you've seen Democrats. So Tim Ryan ran for Senate in 2022, and he had a pretty pro-fracking kind of platform. The sort of like Democratic argument for it is that there are labor union, like the workers who work in the natural gas industry, and particularly with, you know, the energy industry, tend to be, you know, labor organized workers represented by labor unions. The argument is that natural gas, which is what fracking obtains, is cleaner to burn than coal. So it's kind of like a harm reduction sort of thing. You know, whether or not Democratic voters love that, it is the kind of stance that you take in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, where it's an important, you know, aspect of the economy. But yeah, just voters will have to decide how they view this. But it's very clearly Harris staking out a pragmatic position that just reflects the changing circumstances under which she's running.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're the host. I'm not. I'm just wondering if I, you know, Andrew or Aaron, if you've heard, she referred to the, like on the 2020, sound like the debate stage. I cover the one in Otterbein. I do not recall that. And I don't see anyone else who's documented where she said staked out that position later. Is anyone else?
I think it's because President Joe Biden has long opposed a fracking ban being from where he is. And I think when she became part of the ticket, she agreed to sort of abandon or tone down that position because Biden was never going to get on board with it.
But as far as something said on the debate.
I haven't fact checked that.
That reversed her position. Yeah, that deserves more fact checking, folks.
Aaron, you wrote about a bill to make schools publicly post their policy on reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. So Ohio schools are already required to have a policy on whether they say it every morning. Why post it?
Yeah, Representative Gail Pavliga said that she's, you know, a very patriotic person. She was kind of inspired by the fervor of the Olympics recently. And she she's noticed at sports games people not knowing the words of the anthem or standing and putting their hand over their heart. So, you know, she is very passionate about students standing to recite the pledge and said she wants parents to be aware of whether or not the public schools in their district have a policy that requires students to recite it.
I will note that it is illegal to make students recite the pledge. This goes back to a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 1943, so way, way back, saying that you can't be compelled to salute the flag after Jehovah's Witnesses were expelled for refusing to participate.
Right. I should have said whether schools make time for the pledge in their schedules.
Yeah. It's whether, and right, it's sort of, we're going to do this, you can choose to participate.
Right.
And they want that posted somewhere publicly within the school.
That's right. And students can't be intimidated by teachers or their peers into standing and reciting the pledge.
Well, we'll see how it goes. They're not coming back, as we've been saying, until after the November election. So that only leaves like 6 weeks of legislating. So we'll see what gets passed in 6 weeks.
Duck.
Always a fun time. And because we can't let a roundtable go by without talking about House Bill 6, federal prosecutors have outlined why former Ohio Speaker Larry Householder's appeal should be rejected. For those of you that might be new to Ohio politics, Householder is serving 20 years in prison for orchestrating a billion-dollar bailout of two nuclear power plants after the company that owned them gave him about $60 million. Householder has long maintained his innocence. Why are prosecutors saying the appeal should be rejected, other than they think they did a good job?
They think they did a good job. I mean, if anyone thought that, you know, the prosecutors were very adamant in the trial down in Cincinnati for Mr. Householder and Matt Borges, the former Ohio Republican Party chair, also sentenced to 20 years in federal prison.
Six, right?
Six. I'm sorry. Yeah. My bad. You know, if anyone thought they were going to let up in the appellate, no, it's full out. He did it. Here's, you know, as reminding, almost like a reminder to the public, but also more important to the appellate judge panel, saying, look, we established this, all these factors in court, and we have very good reasons why this man should not have a reduced sentence, certainly should not have his conviction overturned.
And the appeals process will continue. I mean, it is Householder's right to appeal his conviction all the way up to the very top. So we'll have to kind of wait and see.
Everything we talk about winds up in court.
Finally, I want to talk about an Ohio Republican lawmaker who wants to punish employers who hire workers without permanent legal status. Tom Patton says employers who knowingly hire people in the country illegally should face penalties. Aaron, we have about a minute left, but what kind of penalties are we talking about?
Well, the county prosecutor would investigate this situation, and then it would be up to the county court of common pleas. But that court can, if this bill passes, suspend a business's license for up to 10 business days and notify the public, put them on a database with the business name and where they were hiring people living in the country illegally.
Is this just a way to push people towards e-verify?
Well, part of the bill is that employers could prove that they had no knowledge of it if they ran their employees through the e-verify system. So yes, there's an incentive there.
And I'll squeeze in one more thing before I say goodbye to everyone. If you commute on the Ohio Turnpike, the agency wants you to know that it's never going to text you about a payment. The Ohio Turnpike does not request its EasyPass customers pay by text, nor does it send fines or unpaid bills. Apparently, this is going around again where people are getting texts saying, hey, you owe us a bunch of money. It's not true. Don't pay it. I want to say thank you to Daryl Rowland, politics and investigative reporter for ABC. Thanks.
Thanks, Anna. And I think you really need to take that sabbatical and come cover Lame Duck again this year.
Oh, it's tempting. And I want to say thanks to Aaron Glynn, state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau.
Thank you.
And Andrew Tobias, state house reporter for Cleveland.com.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
And thank you all for listening to the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News.